Hey, this is Ryan Dawson with my repeat guest, Jeff Blankford, the man that sued the ADL and won. And whew, we got a number of issues to talk about concerning Israel and Palestine. Jeff, how you been? I see you outside there. A nice day, I guess.
I'm sitting outside, that's right. In the next county over is a huge fire that had plumes, according to the fire department, that went 30,000 feet into the air. In 5 hours, it burned 20,000 acres.
Wow.
So right now, I'm pumping water as we speak, which I started just before, a few minutes before you called me. So we have enough water in case we have a fire here. We had a big fire around here in 2008, which wasn't very far from where I'm living. So we have to really be prepared. And given the drought, we have enough water to deal with that, but maybe the fire department won't have it. So we just have to trust our luck. At
Well, at least no lions were killed in the fire.
least what?
No lions got
No
killed.
lions. But there are a number of farm animals up there who probably may have been, but most of the area was not habitable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm
Anyway,
not for chopping heads off of lions or anything, but I was amazed at how much gravity that story got, how much attention that got,
Cecil the
and
Lion.
sees the lion, but immediately afterward, some humans got killed, burned to death. A baby Palestinian was burned alive, and his older brother, 68% of his body's burned. He may die soon as well, by Israeli settlers, terrorists. And very little has come of that story.
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu had the audacity to go to the hospital and visit the burned survivors. But if anybody could be blamed for that act, it would be Netanyahu and his entire cabinet, and not just them, the government of Israel for the last as many years as you want to count. So they promoted hatred of the Palestinians. They refer to them in the newspaper articles as terrorists, as if terrorist is a, and it's not an alleged terrorist. It is a terrorist. And you look at the Jewish press in the United States, and they turn the right-wing Jewish press has turned this around into making who are the victims? Who do you think are the victims? Jews are
Jews,
victims
victims, of
because
course.
who cares about when Jews are killed? I mean, it's just amazing. But this is the tribal mentality that Zionism has like unearthed, like it's like the Moloch or open Pandora's box, and there is all this hatred of the non-Jew coming out of the Old Testament, which somehow many Christians read and don't see. But the call by the genocide, several genocides against people who never harmed the ancient Hebrews, this is the same mentality that you see today in Israel.
Why is there a
And
settler to begin with? Like, what is that? Think about it. A set because it wasn't just Jewish terrorists, it was settler terrorists that did this. Why do they think they could get away with it? And what is a settler actually? Some people don't know.
well, a settler is what everybody in Israel essentially is. These are people who have settled on someone else's land, with or without their permission, but usually without their permission. And in this case, they took the land from the people who've lived there and their families lived there for centuries, and then denied that these people even existed. And you hear the supporters of Israel say there's no such thing as Palestine, but or Palestinians. And you go to a map, and old maps, and you see not only Palestine, but you see hundreds of small villages on these maps that were wiped out by Israel in 1948. And the fact that
But you know what's
Palestine,
not on a
like,
map prior to that date?
pardon?
Israel.
I'm
That's
sorry?
the ironic thing. What is not on a map, on any map before 1948, is Israel.
Is Israel.
That's the state that never existed.
Now, if you go to maps issued by the government of Israel, there is no dividing line between the West Bank. The tourist, for years, I mean, I have maps here from Israel, government maps, and there is no West Bank. It is all Israel to the Jordan River. And in fact, they're being honest. Because since 1967, it has been all Israel to the Jordan River, and the Palestinians live in reservations. And it's an apartheid state, because, and by definition, Israel controls every inch of it. They can go anywhere they want at any time they want. And they need collaborators, so they have Palestinian Authority. And later on, we could talk about the relationship of certain Palestinians in this country to these organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace and U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation.
I do want to talk about them. I want to explain more about settlers, too, because I know they're all squatters. But in the West Bank territory, they have racially segregated roads. They have color-coded license plates. So Jews can go on the road, and then Palestinians get stopped in checkpoints and have to use other roads. There are even racially segregated places to walk, where Jews can walk down this corridor, Palestinians have to go around. They can't walk on the same road. And they have racially segregated cities, where Jews live in enclaves that are paid for mainly by the United States and Germany. All Jews, unonly Jews, not just no Palestinians, no anybody other than Jews, live in these cities that was forcibly taken from Palestinians and protected by armed guards. And this gets into the fire because the settlers routinely attack Palestinian farms, cut down their trees, set fire to their farms, fires, beat people, throw rocks at them, etc. And the IDF just looks on. If there's any retaliation, they go after the Palestinians. So I think that emboldened people to say, let's burn the house too.
That's right. Well, historically, settlers who have killed Palestinians and have been sentenced to prison very soon after the hubbub dies down are released. Because, I mean, there was one, Rabbi Levinger, fortunately he's dead. He died this year, I believe, last year. A total racist American who I mean, his family was from there, from here. And he killed a Palestinian. And he went to jail very briefly, but he was the one who was the one of the founders of Gush Emunim, one of the people who the government allowed the Jews to move into Hebron, which is Al-Halil in Arabic, and take over this town. Just a few hundred Israeli Jews, religious Jews, protected by hundreds of Israeli soldiers. And gradually, they cut the Palestinians off from one section of the town after another. And then Palestinians still had shops down below. Jews were living in the apartments upstairs. They would throw their garbage down on the Palestinians. So when last time I was at Hebron, which was 20 years ago, no, 2004, 10 years ago, you had these nets over the streets the Palestinians had put up because the Jews there were throwing garbage on them. I mean, you have unbridled racism. That here in the United States we have racists, but people won't own up to being racist. In Israel, they are racist and proud of it. And the public statements that are made by government leaders, had they been made by any government leader or official anyplace else in the world, would be condemned by our State Department, our president, resolutions in Congress, and so on. You know, every time there has been some European official who's made some comments that might be at all critical of Jews, you hear from everybody in the United States about it. But right now we have in Israel the most racist government that's, I believe, ever been elected by a democratic form in the West, certainly. And you don't hear about it. You don't hear about it on Democracy Cowed. It's COWED. Mm-hmm. She's great in every place she's at today. She had a great story in Indonesia and the massacres back in mass murder in 1965. But she does not talk about this issue. I mean, if Americans knew the vicious language, racist language, calling for genocide coming out of the mouths of Israeli officials, not one or two, but many of them.
Over and generations. There's
Americans would. Also about Gentiles. I mean, you had the late leader of the Sephardic Jews over there, the Spanish Jews. I forget his last name, Yusuf something or other. Anyway, when he died, he had the largest funeral in the history of Israel. And he, last year, said that Gentiles are like donkeys. They're only there to serve Jews. And this is right out of the Talmud, right out of the Old Testament. And yet, people in this country don't know about it. All these Christians United for Israel would really like to know what Jews in Israel think about them. Of course, Christians United for Israel is an Israel front that was organized by a Jew named David Brog, which the Jewish Forward talked about when he just took a job with Sheldon Adelson on college campuses.
Jewish billionaire, yeah.
To stop the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. But the American public doesn't get this, and all the alternative publications, basically Real News Network, Alternet, Truth Dig, Truth Out, they simply don't write about this stuff.
Well, there are consequences when you write about this stuff.
That's right. I mean,
you can lose your job just for... This is the thing. When you point out the blatant racism from Zionists and Jewish supremacists, you'll get labeled racist.
Oh, yes.
It's completely backwards.
I know. I mean, and you wait to see what people are going to say. I just had an article in Counterpunch on the weekend about the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which was a think tank established by AIPAC in 1985 in order to actually make policy, not just lobby for it, make policy. And it is an Israel front. But the New York Times reports it as just a policy institute. And it's interesting, they are leading the fight. They are leading the scholarship, the intellectual opponents, so-called, of the Iran nuclear deal.
Right.
And we don't hear anything about what they're writing. I subscribe to their mailing list, so I read what they're writing, and I see the publications that their op-eds appear in. Like, for example, the day the deal was announced, five of their op-eds appeared in five major publications around the country, and they're repeated in other publications. So it's like the propaganda is out there, and so they take a poll of Americans and it shows that most Americans are against the deal. Why? Because the media is under the thumb of the Zionist. I mean, once in a while, Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times had an op-ed piece supporting the deal, but for the most part, op-ed people are staying away from it or attacking it from the very beginning. And so you have literally an occupied country. What Gideon Levy said on April 10th in Washington, this is the United States of Israel. No
they
place
against...
in the world would they allow the kind of violation of the sovereignty that we saw with Netanyahu being invited to come here without not informing the government of the United States. And what should have happened is the Israeli ambassador, who used to work for the Republican Party in Florida and is an American turncoat, I call him a traitor, He should have been put on the first plane back to Israel as a message. But no, he's still doing just what he was doing before. Obama has let him get away with it. The one thing about George Herbert Walker Bush, he wouldn't have let him get away with it. I mean, but what happens is you let him get away with it right now. It looks very much that the Democrats are going to cave, and it's very good and likely that a veto by Obama will be overrun. If Obama went in front of the American people and said, members of the Senate need to remember they are sworn to defend the U.S. Constitution, not the Israel, which doesn't have a constitution, and explain honestly what this deal is about, he could get these people running scared, but he's afraid to do that because he would have no future when he got out of office. You see.
They're now coming out with this old stories again, saying, look, they're running guns from Benghazi to Syria when that incident happened and four Americans were killed, which we knew. I already reported that, you know, but they're doing anything to attack Obama, and it's over this Iran deal, and it's something else that happened over this Iran deal. I don't know if that sign's visible behind me. Can you read that?
Yeah, keep Pollard in jail.
Yeah, exactly. Keep Pollard in jail. His parole hearing isn't until November.
November.
And yet, this weird thing happened where they decided to go ahead and meet in July, go over the credentials he's supposed to have met, which he hasn't met, but they said he did, and then say, okay, yeah, we're going to release him in November when the time comes, because he has to be there 30 years. That's backwards. They're supposed to have the hearing after he's served 30 years, not before. But this came at the heels of the Iran deal, as did an increase in aid by another $1 billion.
More than that.
Well, $1 billion increase, right?
Well, no, actually, it was announced in the Jewish press, in the Israeli press, but not in the American press, $1.9 billion more. All
Gosh.
this was more than a month ago. I reported it on my radio program, but I was waiting for one American publication to publish it. I mean,
Nothing.
it wasn't speculative. It was Haaretz ran it, Yedioth Ahronot, the American Jewish Press ran it, and what they said, this 1.9 billion was to buy off Israel.
Pretty much, yeah. So
Okay,
that's
hellfire missiles,
4.9 billion,
bunker
basically
buster bombs.
$5 billion a year now in unforgiven loans. I mean, forgiven loans. They're not. This isn't aid like predatory lending to African nations. This is a giveaway. Here, have $5 billion for nothing, which it gets recycled right back into bribing Congress for more money. I mean, that is the crux of the problem. And the last person to go after it was Robert Kennedy, who allegedly was shot by a Palestinian.
Allegedly, yes.
Yeah, allegedly, with a
Another
gun,
story.
8-shot gun that shot 13 times. But we still have a chance to keep him in jail because legally, it's slim, but legally, the parole hearing should be in November. But there's no uproar about it. And Pollard did a lot of damage to the U.S. I wonder if you could speak about that. Exactly what did he steal? He was a spy, but exactly what did he do?
He stole, he removed and stole so many secrets that Caspar Weinberger, who was the Secretary of Defense, described it. It was there was nothing comparable to it, and he kept making demands for more, and he would take them and copy them. Now it's interesting. There are people who've compared. I mean, and allegedly, the Israelis passed information on to the Soviets. And they were dealing with all kinds of, I mean, they have no allegiance to the United States. They've dealt with the Chinese, with whoever they can deal with, because they know since the sinking of the U.S. Liberty, or the attack on the U.S. Liberty in 1967, that they can get away with anything. They may have their hands slapped when it was found some years back that they were giving U.S. technology to China.
What's
And
ironic too, because they're supposedly an ally of the U.S. because Egypt went to in the arms of the Soviets, and they were. When, this is the excuse, you know, that Israel is the ally because they're anti-communist and fighting against the Soviets. But the entire time, from then to now, that has not been the case, and they stole all the Signet codes, all the first strike plans, everything of value, sold it to the Soviets in exchange for Jewish migrants. I mean,
Well,
that's how racist they are. Like, what do you want? We want more Jews living in Israel. That's
no, actually, they wanted more white Jews in Israel,
right.
because they didn't care whether they were Jews or not. You see, they are so hypocritical and so cynical. About a third of the Russian Jews who came there, an estimated, were not Jews at all. But they said they were Jews. They wanted a white population because the Israeli Ashkenazi European Jews are essentially racist against people of dark skin.
It's
And that
just the
includes.
last colonial empire with a religious theme, because none of those Jews are Jewish. I mean, what is a Jew anyways? Like somebody dumb enough to believe the lies of a rabbi? They're all Europeans. Most of them have blue eyes and things. Like, they're just Europeans that,
Oh, no,
you
they
know,
no, they have brown eyes, but
some
it's
of
the same
them.
thing with you with. They look, they're Mediterranean, they could be Italian, they could, but they're not Middle Eastern.
Yeah, they're not Hebrew, put it that way. Not the original storybook
They don't look anything
Jews.
like the Mizrahim, the Middle Eastern Jews, who are never consulted about, never brought into the Zionist picture, never consulted about what was going to happen to them when the State of Israel was declared. Matter of fact, they were brought in as cheap labor because after they expelled the Palestinians, they needed someone to do the work. And so they sent planes to Yemen to pick up the Yemeni, because the Yemeni in Jewish culture were the lowest of the low. The Germans were the highest, the Yemeni were the lowest. And so they brought in these Yemeni, they did sterilization experiments with them. Yemeni children were also stolen from their parents.
It parallels so much what happened to American Indians, except it's still happening. That's the saddest thing. It really is like the new manifest destiny, and the sterilization and all that happened to American Indians too, and kidnapping and so on. But I think everyone pretty readily agrees what happened to Native Americans was just indefendable. It's definitely wrong, but
I wish you could say that, but my experience is that most Americans don't even talk about it, don't think about it, don't want to hear about it, and they don't learn about it in the public schools. In this area where I live, was one of this state was called the Murder State. There's a book written about it. And in this area where I live, on the very land that I live, people were here back 3,000, Yuki Indians were here 3,000 years ago. And after them came Pomo, and yet I've tried to convince a number of people with whom I live here that we are the beneficiaries. We may have not committed the genocide, but we are everyone who in this country, every immigrant from Europe in this country is a beneficiary of that genocide. But when you live on land that was actually an important part of indigenous culture, like where I'm living now, you really have to appreciate it. And many people just don't think about it. Some will take Indian names, you see.
Yeah. Well, California stuck the last Yaani Indian in a museum, and the newspapers went out saying Stone Age man found, and the reason he was out living by himself was because his entire tribe had been killed, since there was bounties placed, and the government would pay people money to murder Indians. And this is in the 1930s. This isn't ancient history or anything. And, you know, he died of a fever in the museum. It's pretty disgusting. But the sterilization was happening in the 70s. I mean, I was almost born by then. I mean, this is quite recent, and nothing happened. And then, you know, through the 80s, over a million natives got displaced. In the 90s, Clinton started finding places for our nuclear waste and ended up in the Shoshone reservations and things. And you got Las Vegas stealing water from the Navajo and so on. So, that, I mean, it's not. I'm not saying that ended or anything.
I'm just saying you could
never get away with this level of open racism that Israel does today. You couldn't go into a reservation and demolish homes, put it that way.
That's true.
Like, nobody would put up with that. Not that degree. You can go in environmental pretext and steal people's land and stuff. They have other ways. But they couldn't do this direct, you know, ride up, shoot the buffalo, burn the house down. But in Israel, you can. You can just go in with armed bulldozers, smash houses, and say, you know, F you, that's it. And then build Jewish-only houses. That wouldn't stand in America either. If you had white-only, you do have white-only neighborhoods, but if you had it like that, and made it that obvious, nobody would stand for it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Getting back to this situation with Alison Weir, there is an organization called the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. It started in 2002. You would think at some point they would measure their success or failure by the number of settlers they prevented from coming there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, according to the Jewish Virtual Library, outside of Jerusalem, there were 226,000 settlers in 2002. And now there are 356,000 settlers, Jewish settlers in 2013, and probably more since then, not including Jerusalem.
Wait, now some of that is because people from Gaza got transplanted to the West Bank, though.
Well, there weren't that many in Gaza.
Right.
There were only
I'm just saying that because someone else might bring that up.
There were only about 5,000. But the other thing is that I've always questioned the slogan "End the Occupation," because if you ask the average American walking down the street of any city, if I say to you "End the Occupation," what do you think I'm talking about?
Probably Afghanistan or something. 90%
would not know what you're talking about. And consequently, I opposed this slogan from the very beginning, and I believed that what should be the slogan should be a stop USA to Israel. Now, it's interesting, in the 80s,
I found a t-shirt with that on it. Go ahead.
in the 80s, the Central American movement, the Solidarity Movement of Nicaragua, had a national campaign. Call your member of Congress. Don't send $15 million to the Contras. At that time, Israel was getting $15 million a day. But the so-called Solidarity Movement, which is another occupied territory, as far as I'm concerned, and I could make an argument for it, has never, there you go.
I got to get you one of these.
I have a huge poster that a friend of mine, an artist, made in the 80s, Stop Aid to Israel, a big poster, which I sell some copies of.
Well, you get me one of those, I'll put it back here.
Matter of fact, yeah, you send me your address. Yes, send me the address.
I'd love to have that.
Well, in any case, imagine there has never been a national campaign to stop USA to Israel. Now, there have been individual campaigns. We had one in the BART system in 1989, in which we had an ad campaign to stop USA to Israel, and we had a picture of a photographer friend of mine took of an Israeli soldiers beating up a Palestinian woman, and we were able to put these in the BART ads. We got no support from the Palestinian Solidarity Movement. All the left groups that complained to be anti-Zionists were nowhere to be found. New Jewish Agenda, which was the predecessor to Jewish Voice for Peace, another plant in the movement, not to convince Jews to support the Palestinians, but to convince the Palestinians to exclude non-Jews and non-Palestinians from the movement. That's what the whole thing has been about.
It limits it.
Make the Solidarity Movement a Jewish Palestinian thing, just like it is over in occupied Palestine, with the same power relationships. And so that's why Alison Weir, who is white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, the worst, and blue eyes and so on, blonde, they make someone like Alison feel that they question their involvement in this movement. Nobody asked why someone opposed apartheid in South Africa, right?
Yeah.
If you were white, it didn't matter what color you were. You opposed South African apartheid. You weren't asked for your motives. I remember a friend of mine up in Oregon who was with our labor committee in the Middle East. At a meeting in the 80s, a woman, Jewish woman, asked her, she said, "Are you Jewish?" And Marianne said, "Why? What kind of question is that? But this is
the... I tried to join the group, and I wasn't allowed to join... this is just their Facebook group. But I was like, I'm not Jewish, but you know, I'm against the apartheid. Can I join? And they wrote me this polite letter saying no and everything. And so I asked why. He goes, "Oh, so we can join with many other groups and help, you know, fight this cause." And I go, "Well, which group am I supposed to be in? Because I got several races." That's how stupid it is.
Well, this is the problem, is that they make every effort to exclude non-Jews
to exclude the majority of the country.
The majority of the country has no vested interest in the outcome of Israel-Palestine conflict, but they might care where their money goes. And they certainly would care to know that Israel had gotten away with killing 34 U.S. sailors and wounding 171 out of in the cold blood, and that their president of the United States had sent back fighters that were going there to defend them. And there's a guy named Yusuf Munayr, who's a Palestinian, well, he's an Israeli-Palestinian born in Lod, who was working for the Jerusalem Fund. He was plucked by the U.S. campaign to end the occupation to be the executive director of this organization. Well, that's fine. The only problem is he doesn't have a clue about what American people think. He told me in an email that Americans don't care about the USS Liberty. Now, I wouldn't go and tell him what Palestinians care about. But that's the kind of person, these are Palestinians, they're innocent, but they're clueless. They love the fact that Jews support the Palestinians. They're so gratified that they lack critical thinking. And so they have the steering committee with a half a dozen Palestinians on it, an African-American woman, and the steering committee sends this letter to Alison Weir, who is speaking to the American people who are not interested. The American, the majority, she's telling them the truths about Zionism and what Israel and the Zionists did in the United States.
And there's two things with the Liberty, too. You've got the dead Americans and the attack on the sailors and the cover-up. You know, with McCain's father and everything, it's
that's right.
The cover up with Johnson actually lets you reveal a lot about what happened prior to Johnson becoming president and afterward, and the relationship there. That's all I'm going to say.
I don't think John F. Kennedy would have.
No, the Kennedys wouldn't have. They were opposing. Well, it's a long story. I'm not going to open the Kennedy box, but
story, right.
It's very important to start with the Liberty. I'm making a film about the Kennedys, and I'm starting that film with the Liberty and working backwards. It took me a long time to. There's so much about that whole topic, but that's where the direction I'm going currently. But so Alison Weir's gets, and she has the If Americans Knew, and I mean, there's no reason to attack this lady. She's talking to Americans, you know.
She talks to people. Anybody who calls her, she believes the American people need to be informed. And these movement groups do not believe that. And I would argue the evidence is that they've made no effort to reach out to the broad American people. They talk about being part of an anti-racist movement in the United States, but that is not the role of a Palestinian solidarity group. It is to get the yoke of Israel off the decks of Palestinians and out of their land. And the other thing is to expose to Americans what Israel and their friends are doing in this country. And they have done everything to sabotage that. The gray eminence behind all this is a woman named Phyllis Bennis, who I've known for 30 years. She is the major player behind both U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation and Jewish Voice for Peace. And she is very clever. She's very smart. I've known her for 30 years. And she is adamant about not dealing with the lobby. So how clever it is that she was involved in protests in Washington, D.C. that were supposedly anti-AIPAC at the same time the AIPAC conference, but didn't talk about AIPAC. And at the first conference, because he helped out on it, organize and get the physical situation together, Grant Smith of Institute for Research Middle East Peace, Grant Smith was able to get a panel with Alison Weir, myself, and Janet McMahon with the Washington Report on the Middle East. And our panel workshop was packed with people. It was the most well-attended workshop, the only one which we didn't all hold hands and identify ourselves and say why we were at this workshop. And they had to come and tell us to break it up. The place was standing room only, a big room standing room only. That was too much for them. So the following year, they didn't include a panel, but they made a mistake and they left some time in the evening after their conference had closed for us to use the same room. And 125 of the people who had been to their conference came to our conference. And then the third year, they wanted to make sure nothing was going to happen, so we were excluded. So here they're talking about move over AIPAC, occupy AIPAC. The fact of the matter is, this is like the enemy running your operation.
It's controlled opposition.
You control the opposition. And that's
like Chomsky talking about the Iraq War.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Phyllis Bennis.
I'm against the war. Oil, this and that. And never talking about the Office of Special Plans or anything that actually led to the war about Israel. Nope, just... It must be oil or something. It's so frustrating.
I mean, it's very, I'll tell you something. It's very sophisticated. It's very clever. And the problem is if you bring it up to anybody, they get very defensive as people. You know, Amy Goodman is an icon.
Well, they all support each other. Like Chomsky will go on Goodman's, Democracy Later show, and so on, and they just, report and stay in a bubble. And they
So,
won't argue or debate with anybody.
pardon?
They won't argue or debate. They won't allow a
Oh,
debate.
no,
Like,
I
they
know,
never
and
let
I'm.
someone like you or myself talk about the real reasons for the Iraq War. That would never
Matter of fact,
happen.
I'm going to suggest that Alison Weir challenge Phyllis Bennis to a debate on any issue.
That would be great.
Now, Phyllis Bennis, it's interesting. Some years ago, when Chomsky and I were not on unfriendly terms as we are now, in 1991, in the old National Guardian paper, we had opposing views on the Israel lobby. He was on the left side of the paper, I was on the right side. And afterward, a friend of mine in New York suggested that he and I have a debate at the Socialist Scholars Conference that year in New York. And Chomsky sent a note back saying it wouldn't be useful. Then I asked a professor, Joel Bain at Stanford, who was a friend of mine, Jewish, if he would debate me because he also took the same position as Chomsky.
Right.
He said it wouldn't be useful.
Yeah.
Then in 2002, I mean, the same words, in 2002, when I had a confrontation with Phyllis Bennis the last time we spoke, and she said it at this conference in Berkeley. I don't know if I explained to you another program. 2002, Allison arranged a big event in Marin County, a very wealthy county in Northern California, across the bay from San Francisco, which is Israeli occupied territory. This is really bold. So she had a conference hall in which over 200 people attended, and I was speaking. Raja Shahada, a major Palestinian lawyer, an Israeli woman anti-Zionist, and another Palestinian psychiatrist, Jess Ghanem. And they suggested, because I was going to talk about the lobby, I would go last, because we didn't want a whole room to break up and people shouting and screaming. But I went last, and I showed them evidence of what the Israel lobby had done, physical evidence, and I got huge applause. Some people were even crying. So then I go to
Finally,
the next.
someone said it, you know. Yeah.
Huh? No, because no, they were actually, people came up to me afterward. They didn't know all this was happening. I mean, what the Jewish communities in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Berkeley were doing and had been doing, the liberal Jewish communities, was so horrible. And I showed them the paper evidence of comparing, like in Berkeley, a group of friends wanted to make Jabali refugee camp a sister city to Berkeley. We had many sister cities in South Africa and so on. And the big ad they used, the big mailer they used in Berkeley to stop it, was a picture of the Vietnam Wall. And to compare somehow the war in Vietnam with getting Berkeley a sister city. And they had all these Democrats, including the mayor, signing statements that this was they were totally off the subject. We want peace. That was their motto. They took the word because we want
Intentional
peace.
genericness, yeah.
Yeah, and so see that Palestinian flag. Very nice flag.
Yes. Actually, I got that at the Stop AIPAC event in DC in April, that where I saw you. They had
All
this out
right.
on the table, and a buddy from Maryland actually bought it for me. And I was like, thanks. I told him I'd put it up here, so there it is.
I have actually a smaller one my sister made.
Nice.
Actually, so no. So what you have is the hypocrisy, because in 88, an Arab American woman lawyer started a campaign to have San Francisco support two states. Now, I wasn't for two states, but she started this campaign in 1988 during the beginning of the Intifada. Well, two states was not on the agenda. It only became on the agenda when it became impossible. And so money from Jews all over the United States came in. The New Jewish Agenda, the predecessor to Jewish Voice for Peace, and an Israeli agent who was running the Middle East desk for Middle East for American Friends Service Committee took over the campaign. And they made a rule for the speakers who went out to speak for this proposition. You could not mention Israel lobby. You could not mention USAID to Israel. And you could not mention Rabin's order to break the bones of Palestinian hands of the boy of the stone throwers. You couldn't do any of that. That was called taking the high road. Meanwhile, the other side put out a series of mailing pieces, which I have. One showed the United Nations building, another Martin Luther King. all because we want peace. That was their motto, because we want peace. So they stole this. So when I showed this to these people, the evidence of the Zionist, Jewish Zionist hypocrisy, they couldn't deny it. And
do you have any film of these talks?
No, she didn't have that video. It would have been great if she had been.
You should do it. You should try, if you have the energy, to go through and get all the paper documents.
It wasn't even taped. I may have taped it. I have to think about that. I have a lot of tape. But you see, after that conference was over, it was hugely successful. 200 people, and these were ordinary Americans, but you know, people interested. But they were in Marin County. I go over to Berkeley the next day, where they're having a conference, Students Justice for Palestine, 3-day conference, and not a single panel on the lobby. But there is Phyllis Bennis speaking, and I walk in with a friend of mine in a classroom, and she looks at me, she stops speaking and looks at me, and she says, Congress is not Israeli-occupied territory. I mean, she interrupts herself to say this. So she's looking at me at the back of the room. I said, yes, it is. And she said, no, it isn't. I mean, this is really ludicrous. Here she's giving a talk, and she sees me. So then the speech is over, question period comes, and the moderator says that I'm third on the stack to speak. She's whispering in his ear, telling him not to call on me. But he tries to call on someone else. I don't allow him to do that. And I give examples of the Israel lobby power over the Congressional Black Caucus and so on. By the way, her solution, what Americans should do if they're really upset with Israel, write letters to the editor. I kid you not. Write letters to the editor. Don't call your member of Congress. This, Phyllis, if you're listening, you ever see this? You are an asset for Israel, a strategic asset, only equal perhaps in importance by Noam Chomsky. Maybe it's close, nip and tuck at the wire. Because this, imagine, write a letter to the editor.
Hey, I'll tell you right now, Phyllis and Allison can debate, and I'll moderate it. And I will be fair, because I won't have to help Allison at all.
She won't debate. Maybe she won't debate. So anyhow, so I go and see her after the event, and I say, Phyllis, don't you understand? When are you going to understand about the lobby? She says, Jeffrey, the issue of the lobby is dead. Don't you understand? Dead. And so I wrote about this. It's an article called Breaking the Silence, and it's available on the Internet. So I haven't spoken to her since that day. Now, 3 years ago, I went to a conference of the U.S. campaign to protect Israeli occupation. That's the real name of it. Allison's If Americans Knew was a member organization. And because of that, she was able to get a panel workshop of her, myself, and Pamela Olson to speak about AIPAC. It was going to be the only event of the entire conference dealing with the Israel lobby. So what happens? It's supposed to start right after lunch. They have a luncheon speaker, an Israeli woman, and she's talking, and she's talking, and she's talking, and the time for the workshops has begun, and she's still talking. There's Anna Baltzer, this very charming American Jewish woman who works with both Jewish Voice for Peace and for U.S. campaign, and she's just letting this Israeli woman go on and on and on. Phyllis Bennis is there, so is Josh Rubner. These are the honchos.
Mm-hmm.
They could have said, I think she should stop. When you have a luncheon guest and a workshop schedule, you follow that schedule. I mean, you do not make an exception for a speaker who's not very famous, and she was just babbling. And it occurred to me now, it should have occurred to me earlier.
That was on purpose.
That it was done on purpose. So to shorten our workshop, we had a small room to begin with, and it was standing room only, and we didn't have the amount of time we would have had she not let this woman continue speaking. It was done on purpose. They do not want a discussion of the Israel lobby.
If you don't talk about the lobby, it's like, why you talk about any of it? That is the central issue.
It is the Jewish establishment.
Yep.
It's the lobby, political and religious. And there's the exceptions. are so small. Even J Street, which is like the good cop to the bad cop, they still support Israel to the bloody hilt. You know, they may say, "Oh, you shouldn't drop that many bombs. It's disproportionate. You could do a little less bombing on Gaza." You know, that kind of thing. So it's an extraordinary situation. You know, and what's interesting is
Don't bomb their houses because it's bad PR.
bad PR. Don't shoot kids on the beach.
Yeah.
But
if you do, make sure there's no film.
I mean, that was incredible. You have the media, the world media press, watching these kids get killed, and Israel claiming this was a Hamas military base there.
Artillery or something, yeah.
But it's interesting. Before the Jewish Voice piece, there was a group called New Jewish Agenda, and it appeared in the early 80s and started working within the Palestinian community. It was never working in the Jewish community, because in those days I used to occasionally go to events when I lived in the city in which speakers would come from Israel to speak. And there were a number of particularly older American Jews who didn't like what Israel was doing. This would be a great opportunity for a Jewish organization to bring these older people into it, right? But they were absent. Never once did I see a single member of New Jewish Agenda. They were there to work the Palestinians. I was trying to find a letter for the program. I have a file on New Jewish Agenda. One of their rules were you could not talk about aid to Israel. And so the San Francisco chapter was going to actually decided to talk about aid to Israel. They got a letter from the national office, which I have a copy of, in which they said, "You will be kicked out. You will be lose your chapter if you'll be kicked out of the New Jewish Agenda if you bring up the issue of aid to Israel. You should be more like the Orange County chapter, where they know how the Palestinians, they have the Palestinians knowing that they don't bring up the issue of aid to Israel." This is a New Jewish Agenda, and some of the very same people are in Jewish Voice for Peace, and it works the very same way, more sophisticated, but they want to determine how Israel is going to, and Jews and Zionism and all these are going to be discussed, and the limits of how they can be criticized. So they get someone like Ali Abu Nima, pathetic Palestinian, American Palestinian. He edits something called the Electronic Intifada. Sometimes it's very good articles, but he puts out, there's a tweet that he put out that anyone who says, "I will fight anyone who claims that Jews are responsible for the situation in Palestine." Now, excuse me. Maybe the Laplanders, maybe it's the Irish, the Romanians, the Yugoslavians. Who exactly is
Well, I
responsible?
think maybe, and I think with that case is because people conflate Jewish supremacists with Jews in general, and because they'll get a lot of people like it's the Jews, like all of them are in on it or something. Because there are people who are on that level, but it is Jewish racism, and it is Jew. It's in the religion. I mean, it's orthodoxed racism in their
Well,
text and everything.
go on. He didn't say the Jews, which is different. He
Oh,
said
just Jews.
Jews. He said Jews.
That's stupid.
And you see, say the Jews did this, Jews did that. That is very different than saying Jews. The people who fought and killed Palestinians and sold their land were Jews.
Yeah.
People around the world who helped them and
British.
supported them were Jews. Now, many of them supported them because of the Holocaust of World War II and their feelings of guilt and trauma, but it didn't justify it.
But a lot of that actually
And
started in World War
nevertheless,
One.
it didn't change the fact that they did support the ethnic cleansing of Palestine.
Sure.
And come in 67, the same thing again. There was no imperial power supporting Israel in 67. De Gaulle, who was the armorer of Israel before 67, told the Israelis not to attack Egypt. They went and stole a bunch of boats from a harbor in Cherbourg, patrol boats. They actually stole them out of the harbor, a French harbor. So de Gaulle cut them off. That's when the Americans stepped in. But nobody pushed Israel to attack Egypt.
And they tried to assassinate de Gaulle.
Oh,
There was an
well,
attempted assassination
I know.
hiring Corsican shooters, yeah, and that went right back to same old, dead pigeons. Yep.
It's actually interesting. The 67 war had a cause, one cause that no one ever mentions. And that's in 67, the Israeli economy was dead in the water. More Jews, Israeli Jews, were leaving Israel, emigrating, and Jewish immigration had just stopped. Israel was not anywhere on the American Jewish agenda, so they had to, even despite the fact that the Zionists were working as hard as they possibly could, American Jews were really not interested. Did they go on to Tel Aviv on holidays? No, they'd rather go to Paris, to Greece, you know, to London, Berlin. It was a critical situation. I remember reading about it at the time in the newspaper in Los Angeles, and then suddenly we have the war. Suddenly the Jews in America discover Israel, and all over Los Angeles, you thought this is the end, World War II. I mean,
yeah,
the marquees at the Jewish centers, the triumphalism, and I was not interested in the subject at the time, but I thought this was obscene.
Well, also, it should be pointed out, and a lot of people overlook this, that it was only less than 2 weeks after the international peacekeepers that Eisenhower had put in there in 57 got removed. They were there for 10 years.
Yeah.
And they got removed at the tail end of May, and by the beginning of June, Israel re-attacked. But while they were in Sinai, they couldn't attack. And once the UN was out of there, within a week, in about 9 days or so, Israel reinvades and attacks Egypt and attacks Syria.
The other thing is interesting is if Israel...
And they were there to begin with because of a false flag from the Levant Affair. That's what started the 56
right.
War. Yeah. And that's always skipped. It goes 48-67.
That was the first terrorist act against the United States. Israel was running an Egyptian spy ring, espionage ring, which set off bombs in the U.S. and British libraries to try to blame the Egyptians because they didn't want the Egyptians getting close to the United States. And it was a big mess, but for years it was just called the Levant Affair, named after the defense minister. Most Americans don't know about it.
But actually, Pinchas Levant was a fall guy. It was Benjamin Gavili that set the whole thing up.
And Paris, Shimon Peres is the guy who set him up.
And
and he goes on forever. He's like an Energizer Bunny.
Yep.
But anyway, it's interesting. If Israel had not invaded the Suez Sinai in 56 with France and Egypt, France and England as allies, and it was only Israel, Eisenhower would have sent U.S. troops there because he was furious. So he told Israel, you better get out of there or we're going to cut off the tax exemption for Jewish donations to Israel. Like that they couldn't afford. It's just like when John Kennedy was trying to get, and Robert Kennedy, to get Israel lobby the American Zionist Council to register as a foreign agent. If that had happened, all these Jewish organizations would have to register as that work for Israel would have to register as foreign agents. Washington seemed entirely different. That was a red line.
They supported right of return also.
Hmm?
Robert and John supported the right of return for Palestinians.
Right, and he also opposed their getting nuclear weapons. I mean,
and someone shot both
American
of them.
The president has taken those positions since. I mean,
no,
it was kind
I know.
Of a message. But nobody talks about that. I mean, this is why it's really a shame for me is that here so many years have gone by, and I've been probably doing Palestinian solidarity work as long as anybody in this country. I started in 1970. That's a long time ago. And so I've been able to see what it's done and hasn't done. And for me, I could only say, in terms of anything measurable on the ground in Palestine or in the politics of the United States, it has been a complete and utter failure. And there's never been any attempt, as far as I can see, to evaluate why it has been a failure or to even recognize that it's been a failure. Individual groups here and there have done certain things, but the movement itself, which has been, as far as I'm concerned, Zionized, or tribalized, whatever, has simply not done anything. The fact of the matter is, the fact that Palestinians are running it doesn't make it any more intelligent than other movements in which, I mean, Nicaraguans are not running the Nicaraguan solidarity movement. They were involved. There was a Vietnamese here during the war. They did not tell the anti-Vietnam War people what to do. There were South Africans here during the anti-apartheid movement. Occasionally they would speak at events. They were not running the operation. But what happened is that these closet Zionists, crypto-Zionists, decided they wanted to reproduce the situation in Palestine and make the only people who can speak for Palestine Palestinians and Jews who supported them.
Mm-hmm. Which means a few tokens and a whole bunch
like
of turncoats.
But they have been made fools of by these Jews who pretend to be their friends. Now, there are Jews I know who've done a lot for Palestine, but they haven't done it as part of these groups. I mean, I know Israelis who are anti-Zionist. Amir Haas, for example, the journalist, and I know people here. I know people in Canada. They have not done it. They have not tried to use the Palestinians or to tell them what to do or control their language as they have been doing here since I became involved. I'll tell you, 1985, when I was a founding member of the November 29th Coalition of Palestine, which later became the Palestine Solidarity Committee. So a group of all the Marxist, Trotskyist, solidarity organizations and so on, we're going to have a march down Market Street in San Francisco, big mobilization. And because Israel was still occupying southern Lebanon in 1985, we wanted to have something on a demand for the rally, on the flyers, about the, very minimally, U.S. out of the Middle East, something like that. So we go to a big meeting with my friends, including a Lebanese woman friend who was used to broadcast for KPFA and did more for the Palestinians broadcasting for KPFA, a Lebanese woman, than any Palestinian was doing for themselves. But they didn't like her because they couldn't control her. She's now in Beirut. In any case, she wanted to speak at this meeting to get a resolution of opposing U.S. involvement in the Middle East, and maybe saying something about Israel's occupation of Lebanon and the Palestinians. The Socialist Action Group, one of whose members actually still writes today for Counterpunch, and not Jewish, simply, but it didn't matter, the Trotsky, he was at one end of the aisle, and they had another one at the other end of the aisle, so she could not get out to speak. They would not let her speak, a Lebanese woman. This is the left of San Francisco, Marxist, communist, so on. And so a few of us were speaking for Palestine. Some trade unionists there, Jewish trade unionists, said, well, if you want, you could do more for the Palestinians by not mentioning them than by mentioning them. I said, that's what Reagan said about South Africa. But the Palestinians there refused to support this. They kept quiet because they wanted to be friends. They wanted the support of all these left groups.
Yeah, and they didn't want to alienate these brands.
And right. I looked at them waiting for them to speak. And not one of them to speak. Now we go to 1988, 4 months into the Intifada. And I'm no longer in the Palestine Solidarity Committee. I'm with the Labor Committee on the Middle East because we decided we wanted to speak out on issues that the Palestinians weren't speaking out on. Although we had Palestinian supporters, the leadership of the organization wouldn't have anything to do with us. They would send people to monitor our rallies. We had more protests against the Intifada, Israel during the Intifada, than all the other groups.
Did you see all the moles at the anti-AIPAC event last time? They came there to write, you know, crooked stories. They couldn't get any material, so they didn't write anything at all.
Right. And anyway, so going on. So here it is, 4 months Intifada, and I call the head of the Palestine Solidarity Committee, who was appointed to that job because he came from a very important family in Ramallah. He was appointed from Damascus by George Habash, who didn't know what he was doing, and put this guy in there because he thought, well, having this guy in there, I won't mention his last name, very famous last name, Palestine. Anyway, so I call him on the telephone, and I said, Osama, first name. We have to get a resolution. We have to get a demand on this big march, 1988, support the Intifada. He said, oh, it's too soon. We have to go slow. Too soon? I can't believe that. What are you talking about?
It's an Intifada.
The Intifada. The truth of the matter, the Intifada was not supported by Palestinians in this country the way it should have been. Before the Intifada, the Palestinian diaspora, all these organizations had big dinners I used to attend. And they looked down on the Palestinians in Palestine as having sold out and given up. Suddenly they had the Intifada, which was against them as well. No voice above the voice of the uprising, and they didn't. And they were all the Palestinians were divided at the time, so they gave almost no support from this country to the Intifada. It was a shameful moment. So we wanted to have we wanted to have a demand support the Intifada. Realistic, no? Along with the apartheid and everything else.
Of course they wouldn't.
So we were prepared to go to a big general meeting and get a vote on it, right? They called off the general meeting. So then we decided...
Well, no, Jeff, I got to go. I got to catch a train to work, but we'll pick this up again. But basically, there shouldn't be restrictions limiting on who's allowed to talk or what they're allowed to say. And that seems to be the case over and over. Don't talk about the lobby. Don't talk about aid to Israel. Don't talk about the core of the issue. And you're not allowed to join these groups to talk about it unless you meet our, you know, ethnic preconditions and everything. That seems to be the thing. But I could talk to you forever. I do want one of those posters. I'll get you my address later. And we'll just do a part two on this. Maybe you're going to be gone until what, Friday?
Maybe next week.
Next week. All right. We'll do that.
Okay.
All right, take care. Thanks.
You too. Take care.
Peace.